in the way I do with the Senate President Chuck Morse. So looking forward to it.
What does a majority leader do? Obviously, they lead the majority party, but other than that, I really don't know.
So, generally in the Senate, the majority leader sort of leads the floor proceedings. The Senate president is the presiding officer, you know, with the gavel and sets the agenda and things like that. But I generally, as majority leader, lead the debates and try to structure them so that we know with, you know, Senator Susie, who's the minority leader, you know, what's coming, what amendments are coming. And, you know, we run the caucuses of our respective caucuses, Senator Susie, hers, myself, and Senator Morse on the Republican side. And, you know, I tend to probably do a lot of press as the majority leader. And the one thing I've learned is I don't really speak for the caucus until we have, you know, a cohesive position, and then we all speak for ourselves.
Okay. Now, is that different from the Speaker of the House? Obviously, Speaker of the House is a House position, but is that roughly analogous?
Yeah, no, the in the House in New Hampshire, there's also a majority leader and a minority leader. So the Speaker of the House and the Senate President of New Hampshire are the presiding officers. So in each respective body, they are, you know, the top person. So I, you know, I work under Senator Morse, who is the Senate President. That's different from the United States Senate, where the head person is called a majority leader. Right now, that's, you know, Senator McConnell, soon to be presumably Senator Schumer, where the majority leader in the U.S. Senate is the top person and, you know, sets and, you know, all of that. I think what we do in the, you know, New Hampshire Senate, because it's so small, there are 24 of us, 14 Republicans, 10 Democrats. You know, I think we try to function really pretty cohesively as a team. You know, I don't think that hopefully myself and Senator Morse get out that far ahead of our caucus without, you know, having everybody briefed and on board with, you know, what we want to do, how we want to manage things, scheduling, debates, you know, priorities, agenda items, things like that. And we can do it because it's a manageable number of people. So, you know, that's how we functioned. And, you know, I was the majority leader from 2011 through the end of 2018. In the first couple of years, Peter Bragdon from Milford was the Senate president. And then, you know, when he retired from the Senate, Senator Morse wanted to be the Senate president, and we all thought that was a good idea, even though I, you know, was ostensibly the number two person. I just felt that Chuck wanted it, and I was very happy with that, and it's worked out well.
It is Senator Jeb Bradley with us on WASR on a Friday. So the other $64,000 question I have is, how do they decide who becomes the majority and minority leaders? Do they have do people say, oh yeah, I want to do this, and they have an election almost like how you'd pick a class president?
So the way it works in the New Hampshire Senate, the Republicans will nominate, you know, their choice for Senate president when we're in the majority. So we nominated Senator Morse. The Democrats went along with that, knowing we had 14 votes, of course. And, you know, it's pretty gracious in the Senate. So I nominated Chuck, and Senator Susie seconded it on Organization Day. And then the appointments are made by the Senate president. So he appointed me as majority leader, and hopefully the other 12 senators thought it was a good idea. But I have a good relationship with everybody, and we, as I said before, we function as a team. So it works out. Did I lose you?
Oh, there you are. You're there now?
Yep.
Okay. So it's a nice day today, not so nice tomorrow. But anyway, want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you've said in the press lately and get some reaction, if you don't mind. One of the things a few days ago you said, and I agree with this, we can't attract people to live in New Hampshire unless we provide affordable housing. And that makes perfect sense. However, am I the only one who thinks that's easier said than done? Because there's so many tentacles as part of that.
Yeah, so it is easier said than done. That being said, it's vitally important. It's been a issue for a number of years. As you know, New Hampshire's an attractive state to live, to work, to recreate, to raise a family, to retire. We've got a lot going for us as a state, and so that has driven up the cost of real estate and made, you know, in particular, first-time home ownership or renting more expensive all the time, because the demand for housing has outstripped the supply. So over the last 3 or 4 years, the legislature has dedicated a significant amount of new money to what's called the Affordable Housing Fund, and that partners with developers that build projects like, you know, there's one off of Route 109A in Wolfboro that is workforce housing. And, you know, it's higher density, meant to, you know, by virtue of being able to use both lower cost capital and make arrangements with communities like Wolfboro, which was, you know, forward thinking, you know, to implement, you know, this kind of housing. But it's not easy to do it, because you've got both the financing issue, and then you've also got, you know, local zoning considerations, which we don't have an awful lot to say about in Concord. But what we can say something about is the financing. So in 2018, we were running surpluses, and we put about $5 million into the Affordable Housing Fund. In 2019, I sponsored legislation that would have put $20 million into the fund over the course of the last budget. It was amended to be $5 million on an ongoing basis annually transferred from the real estate transfer tax, and we put $5 million in general fund appropriation. So it ended up being a $10 million appropriation, which, quite frankly, was unprecedented for New Hampshire. And I'm hoping that even though we are doing, you know, that ongoing transfer of $5 million every year, to add another $10 million in this budget, assuming we have the capability to do so, which we may well, if there are further stimulus dollars coming to a state like New Hampshire. So we'll have to see what happens. The other piece of the puzzle is local zoning. And, you know, I think everybody wants to see their towns maintain open space and, you know, preservation of farmland and things like that. But at the same time, there are some areas and opportunities, I think, for higher density housing. It could be on, you know, water and sewer hookups and things like that, that would be pretty helpful if towns did what Conway did, because they have such a need for affordable housing for their workforce, which is somewhat seasonal, that they've adopted, you know, a zoning overlay district for affordable housing that I think is going to help them. So it's a, you know, there has to be sort of a comprehensive approach. We can't do it all in Concord. Has to be done, you know, partially by towns. But at the same time, what Concord can provide is more resources. So given the fact that we know there's a need, the business community is crying out for it because New Hampshire is becoming ever more attractive due to the pandemic, due to some of the unrest that we've seen around the country, businesses and people are trying to move here. And we've got to recognize that. And we're not going to be able to accommodate the businesses that want to come here if we can't, provide housing, especially for younger workers who need that, first step housing.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does that $5 million go? Does that go into direct rent subsidies? Does that go into more of an indirect thing? Where does that
go? It goes into what's called the Affordable Housing Fund, where they allocate this money to, partner with private sector developers of affordable housing so that they have better access to lower cost capital.
Okay.
So it is designed to lower the cost of the projects and better facilitate their implementation.
Now, are these loans or grants?
I believe for the most part, it's a revolving loan fund.
Okay. So in essence, that kind of puts the government in the landlord business indirectly.
I wouldn't know. The government's not in the landlord business. The government is partnering with private entities to help in the construction and the initial financing of these projects.
Okay.
But they are run by private entities.
I see. Okay. So
it's not like there's the Section 8 housing voucher program. Those are federal dollars that is designed for rent relief. But we don't in New Hampshire fund that. But the Affordable Housing Fund is different. It's a partnership with private sector developers to build affordable housing.
Okay, so it's to build it, not from the other side
not to
rent it.
Okay. Not to rent, no.
Oh, okay. Are there any other projects in the pipeline right now?
There are, I'm sure, a number of projects around the state, which is why these dollars are important. I know that there's a project that's on the drawing board in Conway called Avesta that would bring more affordable housing, to that area of, it's sort of in the southern part of Conway. But Conway's a town that absolutely needs affordable housing because it's an attractive place to live, ski area, so it attracts younger people. The retail and restaurant businesses, same kind of thing. They need affordable housing there. And it's a critical need to the point that they were able to get the voters in Conway last spring to approve a new ordinance, which helps, on a town level to create higher density zoning areas for affordable housing. And that's, you can't have 2-acre house lots in most of New Hampshire and have affordable housing.
Well, that's true. What do they call that? Snob zoning? When you have a minimum of 2 acres?
I wouldn't call it that. I think people are trying to protect the open spaces of New Hampshire and the historic nature of a lot of our towns. And, so there's good reason for, that kind of zoning restriction. But like anything else, it can, maybe go too far sometimes. And, you have a what happens next if a town is all acre lot or 2-acre or 5-acre lots. Then, projects like affordable housing that really you can with, as long as you have access to water and sewer, have half a dozen units on a single acre in an apartment type building. And I think, we need that kind of housing in New Hampshire, too.
Mm-hmm. It's Jeb Bradley. He's a Wolfboro senator and he's on live here on WASR. Oh, I'm having one of those days. I think it's Friday. Okay, let's move on a little bit. I know we've talked about the budgets before. You had mentioned to the union leader a couple of weeks ago. we're going to have to make some tough decisions. Now, when you mean by that, usually that means some kinds of budget cuts, because we've spoken about the looming shortfall before. Are there any cuts that have already been targeted, or is it way too early for that?
So it's too early for that. I will say this, that, you know, the governor has done a really good job, as he has, you know, for his first two terms, but he's done a good job over the last 9 months managing the pandemic in a lot of different areas, both the health areas, keeping the economy open to the maximum extent that we can practically while protecting public health. But the third leg of that stool is he's managed our budget situation, I think, very well, too. There's a hiring freeze in place, which has been helpful. Some of the new programs that came as a result of the last budget have probably, just by virtue of the pandemic and, you know, remote working, been, you know, slowed down. So between the hiring freeze and programs not being implemented as quickly, I think our budget picture is much better than, you know, what we had anticipated in, you know, April, when people were predicting we could have a $500 to $700 million deficit. We closed fiscal year 20, which ended on June 30th of 2020, with about $150 million deficit. But so far, fiscal year 21, we're running over $50 million ahead. We do have money in the rainy day fund. I expect there'll be, you know, as I said before, because some of the program implementation has been somewhat slowed by just remote working and the nature of COVID, that quite a few dollars are going to lapse back into the general fund. So I feel like our budget situation is in decent shape. Obviously, we're not running the surpluses in this budget cycle that we have in the past because of the pandemic. But there's also, you know, the likelihood now of further federal stimulus that's going to provide direct funding, if you will, for state and local governments. And that's something that hadn't happened in previous federal CARES relief packages for the COVID. The dollars went, you know, for business relief, individual checks, healthcare, you know, COVID vaccines and testing and, you know, all those types of things, but no, you know, you can use the money for whatever you want to type of dollars. I suspect that new administration, you're going to see, you know, those direct grants that come with precious few strings. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but certainly, you know, Vice President and President-elect Biden indicated that, you know, on Thursday evening that was going to be part of his plan, I think to the tune of $350 billion. That could provide a lot of, you know, help in New Hampshire's situation, although we've managed pretty well. So there, you know, there are some people that think, geez, there's nothing but a bailout for states that haven't managed well. So, you know, while I might have some qualms about it if I were still a member of Congress, if it's coming our way and we don't use it, it's just going to go for other purposes in other states. And I think what, you know, Governor Sununu would probably choose to do is use it on a lot of one-time expenditures that, you know, are infrastructure related. So, you know, there could be acceleration of the 10-year highway plan to repair roads and bridges, broadband deployment, which is a absolute priority for me. And I, you know, just signed off on my matching grant legislation for broadband deployment throughout, you know, more rural areas of New Hampshire. So, you know, I tend to think that, you know, our budget situation will be okay. Federal relief will make it probably, you know, we'll be able to do more than we might have anticipated. But I will say that, you know, with our nation now, we're going to be pretty close to $30 trillion in debt soon if we keep passing these stimulus bills, and we have, you know, the deficits that we're running anyway on a yearly basis, the piper will come due at some point in time, and that, I think, is going to be a concern that it doesn't seem as if too many people in Washington are really paying attention to.
It's hard to even wrap your head around the fact that it's $25 or $26 trillion right now in the federal debt. And as you alluded to a minute ago, I should say President-elect Biden came out with a new stimulus plan that was almost $2 trillion. Have you had a chance to look at this? Your comments?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly what I've seen on the news, you know, he's talking $1,400 checks for anybody with $99,000 or less income. That's on top of the, you know, $600 that just recently went out to, you know, people that were income qualified. More money for vaccine deployment, which, you know, there's been some slowdowns that, you know, some states have had. I think we're doing fairly well in New Hampshire, and I'll get to that in a minute because that's important. So who knows what other types of add-ons will be, you know, in that package when all is said and done. There's some extraneous things like an increase of the minimum wage to $15, the state and local aid that I, you know, talked about before, $350 billion. You know, but it's a moving target at this point, too. I mean, when it gets to Congress, it's going to be rewritten, I would think, in a lot of different ways. And we'll see, we'll have to see, you know, what happens. Before getting on this interview with you, Eric, I was talking to Congressman Pappas, and he also indicated that they're really going to push for an infrastructure bill. So I think there's going to be a lot of Washington dollars, you know, flowing. I, again, continue to raise the concern that, you know, I had when I was in Washington, and our deficit was, you know, a fraction of what it is now. And when I, you know, left Washington, we had reduced our deficit to about $150 billion, and now we're, you know, in the range of well over $1 trillion just on an ongoing basis, to say nothing of the stimulus. So, I, you know, it's a warning, and we need to pay attention to it.
No, I agree. 12:26 on WASR as we talk to State Senator Jeb Bradley. Since this is more of a trial balloon, and you have the experience, does this plan have any chance in hell of passing, or is, as you say, it's going to be rewritten, it's going to be a completely changed thing?
Well, I do think it'll be rewritten. How completely it'll be changed remains to be seen. I think, you know, Speaker Pelosi, even though she lost a number of seats, has, you know, she's not a compromiser, as people know, and I suspect that she's going to break arms to get a $2 trillion package through the House. Now, you know, she has a slender majority. I think it's 222 to 213, which means, you know, she can only lose 5 or 6 votes on any given day, and they're going to be, you know, more than that moderate House members that could balk. For instance, you know, there's a lot of support by Democrats for a $15 an hour minimum wage, but that is going to devastate the hospitality industry that's already, you know, hard hit, you know, to say nothing of, you know, retail and first-time job seekers to go from 725 to 15 all in one fell swoop. So does that, you know, change to something, you know, more modest? I mean, that would be one thing, I would think. You know, we'll see what happens. I you know, then you have 51-50 in the United States Senate. You know, and there are a number of, you know, more moderate Democratic senators like Batista from Montana or Manchin from West Virginia, who may balk at some of the, you know, add-ons that people are talking about, you know, in the Biden plan right now. So I think it will change, and how it changes is going to be fascinating. But something's going to pass. There's no question. I think there is likely to be broad support for another round of, you know, individual checks, probably another some additional help for the unemployed over and above what was in the last stimulus that passed in December. I think that's likely. And I do think that there'll be more money for, you know, better deployment of vaccines. So, you know, those are things that I think there will be pretty broad bipartisan support. We'll see what happens with some of the rest. But if I could, can I touch base on the New Hampshire vaccine plan that was discussed yesterday? Because I think people are going to be pretty interested in that.
Absolutely. It was on my list of questions.
Okay. So Governor Sununu announced yesterday sort of a broadening of the vaccination plan. We're in what's known as phase 1A of the plan now, which is for high-risk health workers, first responders, and long-term care facility folks. They're in the process of getting vaccinated right now as we speak. We are about to enter what's known as phase 1B, which had been until yesterday for people in New Hampshire over 75 years of age and older, or people that had that were labeled medically vulnerable, that they had two or more conditions, and then folks that work with the developmentally disabled community, corrections, and other first responders and healthcare workers that were not deemed to be in the highest risk category. So that is now, you know, over 75 has dropped to over 65. And what people need to do if they're in that category is register at the, and I'm looking, where did I make my notes? Hang on a minute. There's a way to register, and it's at www.nh.gov/COVID-19. Let me repeat that. www.nh.gov/COVID-19. And that's starting a week from today. People can register on January 26th for a time and a place if they're over 65 or in any of those other groups that I highlighted, or potentially under 65 if you have co-occurring conditions. And I believe with that you would need a doctor's note or whatever to qualify for that. So people should register starting next Friday, and starting January 26th, people will be able to go to some of the listed sites that will be on that website where you can actually get the vaccination. And then 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, you'd get the second shot of the vaccination. So that's the, I've been getting quite a few questions from people, especially people over 75. That's the how-to of how to do it. So, you know, Eric, for folks that may not have a computer, may not have access to a computer, I believe that they could do it to a family member, you know, that has a computer. Physicians, health clinics, hospitals, where you get your primary care, if you can't register yourself, they ought to be able to walk you through that process of, you know, how to register. And again, it starts a week from today.
Okay, and that, once again, that is, by the way, it takes you to a very cool page. So it's nh.gov/COVID-19. And right on the right-hand side, it says vaccine phase check. And it will ask you some questions as to where you fall into that, whatever that is, that schedule. As
that
to who,
category,
right,
yes.
That category, in yep. Which category that you fall into. And then you can check that based on, it'll tell you what date you can start registering and then what date that the vaccinations will be available. So once again, that's nh.gov/COVID-19. While we're on the subject, we were talking earlier a little bit about roads and transportation. And I don't know if this is true or not, because as you know, Wikipedia is not the most reliable source of information on the planet. But it said that the last time the gas tax went up here in New Hampshire was 1992?
No.
Okay.
I think it was...
I thought it sounded a little funny.
It was either 2000, I think it was 2014. It went up by 4.5 cents per gallon. So
would it enable our roads and bridges to be better maintained if we tacked another penny onto the tax? According to what I've seen, that could raise another $40 to $50 million.
Roughly, the formula is about, for every penny that the gas tax goes up, about $7 million gets raised. So, I mean, look, I did not vote for it 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't really like raising taxes. That being said, I think it was helpful in expediting some road construction projects. We do have, you know, a long list of red-listed bridges, so I'm sure it'll be discussed, and we'll see, you know, how it goes.
Okay. We also mentioned earlier your work with broadband. How is that coming? I've also noticed that there are a couple of towns that have allowed cable competition. Is that a local decision, or is that a state decision?
No, that's a local decision. Towns contract with their broadband providers. Like, for instance, in Wolfboro, we have Atlantic Broadband, and it's a contract that Wolfboro enters into with the cable provider. So that's how it works in most places. So what my legislation is going to do is create a matching grant initiative that would better deploy broadband. And it's been written not to include the planning phase, which is a pretty important phase. But unfortunately, you know, as an individual senator, I don't draft my own legislation. It's drafted by attorneys, and I had to sign off on it the other day. So I'm going to, you know, try to amend it to include the planning as well as, you know, the actual deployment of wires. And, you know, I would hope that, and quite frankly, I'd expect that if there are going to be stimulus dollars that go directly to, you know, states, that this would be something that we could utilize, you know, to put into a pool for matching grants. So the way my legislation is structured, it is a 50-50 match. And on one side, there's the opportunity for state funds and federal funds to match local funds. And, you know, a town like any of the, you know, any town in New Hampshire that has a provider, whether it's Atlantic Broadband or Spectrum or Comcast, you know, could work with those companies in terms of meeting the municipal match. So, you know, there would be four avenues, if you will, of funding. And I think that, you know, this probably doesn't need to run forever as a matching grant initiative, but certainly, you know, there's broad support for it because of, you know, what the pandemic has shown us, that, you know, we need broadband in as many homes as possible, and a lot of people don't have it. And so you've got, you know, education problems, telemedicine is increasingly important, the ability to work from home is important, and just, you know, more and more people are using greater broadband services. And so, you know, the need for more, you know, bigger cable into the house, so to speak, more capacity is growing.
Bigger pipes, in other words.
Bigger pipes, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We're talking with Senator Jeb Bradley here on WASR, and right now our conversation is revolving around his broadband bill, 569-5253, if you have a question about that or anything else. What type of time frame do you think would work with this kind of legislation? You had mentioned that it probably shouldn't run forever. It's obviously meant as a kickstarter, I think. What type of time frame do you see?
So here's what I'm hoping that we'll do. I was told that I had 14 out of 24 senators co-sponsoring it with me. So I'm off to a really good start, and I've got significant House, you know, co-sponsorship too. I would hope that we would pass it. It will probably go to the Commerce Committee, would be my guess. It could go to Energy and Natural Resources, but more likely the Commerce Committee, although it could go directly to the Finance Committee. And at the end of the day, we will probably table it in the Senate to put into the budget when we get the budget from the House in April. That is probably the best way to make this happen and to be able, I didn't put a specific dollar target for general funds in it. That's something I think we would do in the Senate. I don't know what that is. I, you know, want to work with the governor's office on that after he's announced, you know, his budget, you know, to see what kind of general funds are available. But a lot will depend on, you know, what we see out of Washington. And that's why before I got on the phone with you, I was talking with Congressman Pappas, and, you know, we were discussing that because I made the entire federal delegation aware of how important this is for New Hampshire, for the reasons I listed previously, and that if they're going to provide stimulus dollars, either, you know, it can be in several different forms, unencumbered, you know, no strings attached, or if it, you know, specific to broadband, that works too. But this is something that, to me, is a real necessity.
Okay. Senator Jeb Bradley, as we talk about broadband and all kinds of other things. Now, does your bill define broadband? I know the FCC has tried to define it, but the FCC has its own issues.
I think it's defined, and I don't know what the terminology stands for, but an upload speed of 25 megabits, I think.
Yep. That's megabits per second. Yep.
And some people would urge that it be at 100, but, you know, we'll take it one step at a time.
Well, for those of you who are not geekily inclined, 25 will do perfectly for just about everything except HD video streaming. You might not quite have enough bandwidth for that. But anything else, like schoolwork or, you know, whatever, YouTube, Facebook, it would be fine. And upload speed, of course, is far less important, which is usually why it's slower than the download speed. See, now you learn something about Internet service.
Well, thank you, Eric. Yeah, no, I...
Okay, well, okay, I thought you were going somewhere with that. Sorry about that. So we're talking with Senator Jeb Bradley, and we're talking about broadband and budgets and you name it. I'm curious about your reaction to what happened recently in the Capitol building. We have, it's funny, we were talking about this morning here at the radio station. You know, we have soldiers sleeping on stone floors. I'm a little confused by this whole thing. Is that, in other words, Which soldiers are those? Do you know? Is that the National Guard? Is that the Army? Is the Capitol Police? All of them?
I believe it's the National Guard that you're seeing on TV.
Okay.
And, you know, appropriately so. I think, you know, we need to make a strong statement that, you know, the security of the Capitol, the White House, you know, people that work in Washington, you know, it's got to be front and center. And, you know, it's increasingly coming out that, you know, what happened a week ago, there had been threats for some time prior to that online type of situation. There's no place for that in the United States of America, none whatsoever. And, you know, I'm glad to see that this time around they're not taking any chances. I think they were maybe caught a little bit short. And the, you know, former head of the Capitol Police, who did resign, has indicated that, you know, he had reached out to other authorities for backup help at that rally last week. That is not to excuse, you know, President Trump for what he, you know, what he said and incited people. You know, that's not an excuse at all, but the security was not good enough. And, you know, we got to learn from that. And I think you will see, even though, to the best of my knowledge, there's not going to be any activity in the State House on January 20th because we're doing everything remotely. You know, there will be a presence of folks there to make sure that the security of the, you know, that facility is taken care of also.
Yeah, I've also heard the federal courthouse might be the scene of some protest. Now, that does not necessarily mean they're going to be violent, of course. People have the right to protest still.
Absolutely.
Even in this, you know, even in this environment. And all I can say is if you are planning on protesting anything, have at it. Enjoy. Rock on. Just don't break anything. That's, you know.
Yeah, and I think people also have to realize your words matter. You know, and, you know, it's fine to protest and raise your voice, but, you know, if your words are urging violence, that's a problem. And it's a real problem. There's just no place for that. And, you know, I said the same thing, you know, and I bet if you pulled out all the interviews we did all summer and fall, Eric, said the same thing about cities around the country, that, you know, there were mobs and violent protests from the left. Inexcusable, just as, you know, mobs and violent protests on the right. Inexcusable.
Yeah, it doesn't matter which side of the aisle, as it were, you are on. But anyway, maybe you can kind of explain what happened as far as the impeachment vote. I don't understand it. And I know I've talked to a lot of my friends that don't understand it either, because he's only going to be in office for five more days. The Senate isn't even in session. So is this academic? Is this just, is this partisan, just knee-jerk? What is this?
So let me just say, you know, because I've been asked, obviously, I been in Congress, I would not have voted to impeach, because I think the temperature in this country needs to be reduced and the passions need to subside a bit so that we can have rational discourse and we can treat each other as friends and neighbors, not as, you know, a Republican tribe and a Democratic tribe. I mean, they're just, you know, we obviously have our partisan differences, and that's good. You should have that. But, you know, when it boils over to the point that it has, it just harms us as a country. And I felt that, you know, even though the president's words played a role in what happened last week, and, you know, he has to be held accountable for that. And, you know, for him, you know, his popularity is dropping like a stone at this point among, you know, his supporters. People are pretty upset. And you know, there has to be accountability, but an impeachment with no due process, it's really nothing more than throwing gas on a fire, and it's not going to calm passions. It's only going to heighten them. And then you throw on top of that, Eric, you know, the moves by Twitter and Facebook and Google and Amazon and, you know, all this other stuff about censorship of, you know, opposing ideas. I mean, you know, Twitter allowing dictators around the world that, you know, are spewing violence to still tweet, but they've permanently closed the president of the United States. I mean, that's censorship, plain and simple. And the big tech companies are, in my opinion, violating antitrust law. You know, so there's a lot that people are pretty upset about. You know, and obviously we saw a lot that people were pretty upset about, you know, all summer long in a different fashion. But it never is an excuse for violence. And, you know, I think that I hope there's a reckoning for these big tech companies that seem above the law.
Well, if anybody could start it, Senator, you'd be in a position to do that. I don't know if legislation is the answer. You can't legislate everything into peace and happiness, but it might be an interesting concept. I don't know.
I suspect that
that would
this
be
is
what,
going to have to come from, you know, the federal Congress. And you know, right now it would appear that my Democratic friends feel that, you know, big tech is their ally. But, you know, be prepared for what you ask for. You might just get it. And
yeah.
Censorship is rotten at its core. And it fundamentally will, you know, change our country, and not in a good way. But, you know, I think it's up to the United States Congress, the U.S. Department of Justice, to look at, you know, the Section 230. And
I was just going to mention that.
The exemption that they have from, you know, liability, because they're platforms, not publishers. But they are obviously censoring content. You know, and then the antitrust activities that went on basically to eliminate Parler, which is a more conservative-leaning platform, you know, that's no longer available in the App Store. So, you know, I saw earlier in the week, I haven't checked it, that Twitter and Facebook stocks plunged. Good. That's, you know, a response that hopefully gets their attention.
And I agree that this really doesn't look good, but technically, they're a private business, and they—I don't think they're breaking any laws by censoring, as it were. It, you know, the first time
May not be breaking any laws in censoring, but I suspect that they are colluding in terms of eliminating competition, okay. And that's antitrust. And okay. What they did to take Parler down would appear to have violated antitrust provisions, and I think that's something that, you know, people on both sides of the aisle in Washington should be pretty concerned about, because, you know, what can happen today to one side of the aisle can happen in the future to the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, that's very true. We're speaking with Jeb Bradley, and lives, of course, in Wolfboro. Oh, my wire just came out. Oh, well, anyway. Thank you very much for listening. If you have a question, 569-5253, we have a few minutes left here as we talk about everything that's going on. One of the things that and it drives me crazy, and I'm not really a politician, is some of the hand-wringing going on, usually on the left, that there won't be a peaceful transfer of power, and the military will have to come and physically, you know, oust Trump from the White House. I have no love for the man, but I don't think it's going to come to that. Or am I just being naive?
No, I don't think it's going to come to that.
I mean, he's not stupid.
No, I don't think it's going to come to that at all. I mean, I think that, you know, his comments, the president's comments subsequent to, you know, last Wednesday and the riots at the Capitol have been ensuring a smooth a smooth transition. I think Mike Pence has really stepped up and, you know, taken the reins, so to speak, on a lot of different areas. And, while the president may not be there at the inauguration of President-elect Biden, Vice President Pence has said he will be there. So I think that that's, I hope it's unfounded. Let's put it that way.
It just, it doesn't even seem possible, to be honest. I know a lot of people, you know, think the man is, you know, should be wearing horns and carrying a pitchfork, but I don't see that at all, hopefully. In our last roughly five or so minutes, though, Senator, I'd appreciate it if you could kind of fill us in on how the pandemic has affected what goes on in Concord. I know this, you have a lot of Zoom meetings and things like that, but there's issues of internet security and other things, but the business of the Senate continues to go on, correct?
Yeah, no, we're, I think, doing fairly well. And again, it's very helpful for us to have only 24 senators. Things are a lot more manageable than 400 House members. Just by the nature of 400 House members, it is far, far more difficult. You know, and I think that Sherm Packard, the new speaker, is, you know, doing the absolute best job he can. He's a really good guy. And, you know, he's going to work as hard as he can to be as inclusive and make it work. But, you know, going back to the Senate, we have conducted hearings this week. We chose relatively non-controversial bills for hearings. It's going to be the same next week. We're sort of looking at this as a bit of, you know, trial by fire, and we're trying to keep the flames low to begin with. And it worked out pretty well. Our staff is unbelievable. They've managed to understand how Zoom works. And, you know, we've had these hearings now with 100 people or so as attendees. We're doing okay. We've allowed for public access and transparency, and people have been able to testify. And, you know, there's some kinks to work out, like if people have submissions. So if somebody has a letter to the committee, getting that ahead of time so we can put it on a website so everybody can see it. There's still some things that have to be worked out, but we're trying to do that. I think our sessions, when we start them in February to begin with, will be remote. We have purchased some HEPA air filtration systems that, you know, as people get vaccinated, and half of the Senate is over 65, so, you know, by March timeframe, you know, a lot of senators may well have been vaccinated, and we may be able to start coming back. But I think, you know, Senator Morris has taken a very practical approach. Let's not tie our hands, you know, too much too soon, but let's be smart about what we're doing. And right now, it's remote. So that's what it is.
Okay. In our last remaining minutes, tell me a little bit. I know we talked about it at the beginning of the program about what the majority leader does, but what's on your plate coming up for the next medium term, month to 3 months?
So as I've, you know, tried to stress to everybody, you know, given, you know, what we just talked about and remote sessions and things like that, we're just not going to be able to process the number of bills that we have in the House and the Senate. The House has about 700. We have about 300, although we've combined a number of them into larger bills, and hopefully that works smoothly, yet to be determined. I think it will. So less is going to be more. And I think we need to focus on the things that are really, you know, the top priority items. The budget clearly is one of them. Things like, you know, the broadband initiative, you know, that I talked about is going to be very important. Education funding, that is generally part of the budget. But, you know, we've got to, you know, look at that very carefully. I think there'll be an effort to, you know, change some of the bail reform provisions that we've had that I think went too far too fast, and, you know, letting violent criminals out of jail without bail and repeat offenders. So, you know, there'll be things like that. And then, you know, some things that are fairly easy will pass. Like, for instance, one of the hearings this week was authorization for Brewster Academy not to have to go to the legislature every time it wants to amend its charter. You know, that was one of the bills last year that got caught up in the COVID situation, passed easily in the Senate, would have passed, I'm sure, in the House, but it just didn't because of COVID. We had a hearing on that. It's going to be on the first Senate calendar. Things like that that are easy will happen too. It's the things that are more complicated that may not be top priority that I think some of that's going to have to wait till next year.
All right. We are just about out of time. Again, Senator Jeb Bradley of Wolfboro. Unfortunately, tomorrow, not good hiking weather. It's going to be nice and warm, too. But I'm sorry. I hope you have a great weekend, and thank you again for your time. Congratulations again on being the majority leader.
Thank you very much, Eric, and look forward to talking to you next Friday.
All right. Take care, Senator. Thank you. It is 1 o'clock. News is next.